Chapter 34. The Oyster Baron. By early 1972, my partner Charlie and I had been living together in a small terrace house in Yonge Street for a little over 2 years. At this time, I had the opportunity to renegotiate my second mortgage with the Independent Order of Rechabites. As it stood, the bank held the first mortgage, and my mother held the second. As there'd been some ructions with my mother regarding her stake in the property, I was extremely grateful to be able to find another source of finance. The IOR representative, a committed teetotaler, was an associate of my boss, who owned and ran the Argent Manufacturing Company, where I worked as a packaging designer. When the mortgage documents were signed and sealed, Charlie and I had a bit of a giggle, because we were both regular tipplers. Our spiffy renovations complete, I noticed my clothes were tighter. My body shape had changed, the direct result of my cooking. Our need to economize meant sourcing the cheapest cuts of meat, mostly fat-laden mince, that I presented in a myriad of creative ways. I joked that I'd write the definitive recipe book with mince as the hero ingredient. But this became less and less likely, because by the end of our renovating stint, I'd not the slightest interest in mince, or cooking it. I was now carrying the result of our diet, so my next project was to tackle the extra kilos. Casting around, the solution quickly presented itself: Weight Watchers. Weight Watchers was the first of numerous organizations to offer a foolproof weight loss program to overweight Australians, in weekly meetings held across the country. I signed up in late September, and every Thursday afternoon after work, I religiously toddled along to weigh in and listened to a diet-related pep talk at a church hall, not far from Yonge Street. To survive the stringent Weight Watchers regime, I felt a weekly treat would help me stay on track. With the renovations complete, we now had more cash, so I knew the cost of a dozen George's River Rock oysters on the shell wouldn't break the bank. I had my first natural oyster encounter whilst eating out with my food-loving father, after which I was a goner. Now, some years later, I'd no idea where to source fresh oysters in Sydney, because for the duration of our relationship, Charlie's serious seafood allergy meant seafood of any kind had been off the menu. Asking around, a friend suggested the Sydney fish markets at Blackwattle Bay, not far from Annandale. The following Saturday morning I took myself off to the fish market, where I saw a sign reading New South Wales Oyster Distributors, and I wandered in. A drop-dead gorgeous Greek fella welcomed me, and, after the initial greetings, I asked the burning question: "How much do you charge for a dozen oysters?" He explained. Opened oysters on the shell were so much, and unopened were less. Always keen to save money and being a practical person, I asked him if he could show me how to open an oyster. My request was taken up with enthusiasm. In a trice, the Greek wrapped his arms around me from behind and guided me through the process. After this unexpectedly cozy experience, I opted for the already opened oysters, erring on the side of common sense, as a sharp oyster knife in the hands of a novice could be dangerous. The very next Saturday I returned to the oyster shop. Once again, I made my purchase of a dozen plump fresh oysters, and as I was leaving, the handsome Greek asked me where I lived. Caught off guard, I didn't want to give him my address, so I thought of a number, any number, but wasn't quick enough to change the street name as well. And I thought no more about it. Since my mother's fancy Carmen gear had been shipped back to New Guinea, I'd been driving an aging pale green Fiat 600. I loved it. Our Italian mechanic had fiddled with the engine, after which the car's performance improved out of sight. It was nippy, powerful, cheap to run, and just perfect for getting around Sydney. But it was quite conspicuous parked out in front of the Yonge Street terrace. On that fateful Friday afternoon, I hadn't been home long, when there was a knock at the door. Before me stood the handsome Greek oyster baron, bearing gifts. A large tray with an arrangement of magnificently fresh seafood. There were Balmain bugs, king prawns, and of course, a dozen oysters on the shell. I introduced him to Charlie, and after graciously accepting his gift, I sent the latter-day Adonis away, not knowing what else to do. Another week passed, and come Saturday morning, I once again toddled down to the fish markets to purchase my regular seafood indulgence from the Greek god. Negotiation complete, he then asked me out to dinner. To my surprise, I accepted, before I'd had time to realize the implications of what I'd done. How would I explain this to Charlie? As our relationship had been on hold for quite some time, I wondered if this handsome Greek would be the catalyst for us both to move on. On the appointed midweek evening, Yanis picked me up in his splendid red Volvo sports coupe, and we headed to Crow's Nest, a North Shore suburb, with a selection of swank restaurants. Over dinner, he told me, amongst other things, that he carried a revolver. I was stunned, as no one in my circle of friends or acquaintances owned a revolver, let alone wore one. I did my best to conceal my shock, and after I'd regained composure, I felt compelled to ask him the obvious question. Why? He shook his head, replying, "Bloody Greeks, you can't trust them." Charlie could see the writing on the wall, and moved out the following week. And so began the most meaningful relationship of them all. On reflection. Mortgages. I purchased Young Street, Annandale, for $9,000 in early 1970. My mother's bank manager willingly provided the first mortgage of $5,000, and my mother topped up with an unregistered second mortgage of $4,000. Having raised the total purchase price, I was able to use the $1,000 from the compulsory savings account set up by my father as working capital for the renovations. For the first year and a half, it was very tough financially, but the experience provided a lasting cure for my spendthrift ways. Weight Watchers. Over a six-month period, I regained my slim trim body shape, whilst at the same time acquiring sensible eating habits that have stayed with me ever since, with only the occasional wobble. Charlie. Charlie was, and is, a very smart, quiet fella. I was his first serious girlfriend, and the first he'd lived with. At home, we fell into the customary Anglo-Australian gender roles of the early 1970s. I took the focus for our meals, housekeeping, and renovation planning, in addition to a full-time job. Thankfully, I was able to avoid the clothes washing task, as the laundry at Young Street had become the kitchen in the room reshuffle, so we used a nearby laundromat instead. Charlie helped to renovate, and took the focus for paying the quarterly bills, and I took responsibility for both mortgage repayments, plus the never-ending renovation costs. Reflecting upon our relationship, I realize we were a great renovating team. But once we'd discussed the technical challenges, found and implemented a suitable solution, we had little to talk about. I wasn't particularly interested in economics, and Charlie wasn't at all interested in art. Our split, when it came, was amicable, with no arguments or fireworks. Afterwards, Charlie resumed his pre-Young Street lifestyle, with the Birchgrove pub becoming his favourite haunt once more. We remained friends, and he was very kind to me when the Greek Odyssey came to a sudden end. He obviously still cared for me, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Yanis Aronis. I was prepared to take the risk and see where this unexpected association would lead. I knew it'd give me the opportunity to explore another culture from the inside. And it did. Facts. Independent Order of Rechabites, also known as the Sons and Daughters of Rechab, is a fraternal organization and friendly society founded in England in 1835, as part of the wider temperance movement, encouraging total abstinence from alcoholic beverages. Always well connected in upper class society, and involved in finance, it gradually morphed into a financial institution, explaining why I was able to refinance my terrace house with them, in 1972. In Australia, The Iowa was first established in Tasmania in 1843, soon spreading to other states. Iowa branches, also known as tents, still exist in some Australian states, though membership has fallen away over the years.